beyond that, I have to check. The guest is not with us yet, is he? He is. Oh, I'm very sorry then. I owe him an apology. I owe him two apologies. Are you there, Yash Tandon?
Hello, yes, I'm here.
How do you do, sir? I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were on the line.
No problem, I've been listening to you.
We've been working zealously to have you online because you've written, to my mind, two wonderful texts that have fallen into my hands. One of them is titled, Trade is War.
Yes.
The West's War Against the World.
That's right.
And a second book that I've chosen to call a chapbook, The Trump Phenomenon and the Emergence of a New World Order. Trump is a reality embedded in the American political landscape. Your books could not be more timely because all we hear about, frankly, in our environment now is trade, free trade, trade war.
Right.
And you have already kicked it up a step because your title is Trade is War.
That's right.
I wonder if I could, just two words I want to make sure I say at the top that, to my mind, what sets you apart and as a thinker and writer in our political context and actually puts you, is why you're so important in my mind. You use two words that in Canadian and American political culture have been banned or are verboten. One is capitalism,
mm-hmm.
and the other is imperialism.
That's right.
And here we are with the subject of, everybody agrees, trade war, but they don't discuss ever here, except, well, we're getting little green shoots, I guess we should say. There is a congresswoman now who talks a little like this, and we have Bernie Sanders. But frankly, it's been excluded, and we're told, one more item to cite, you actually met Herman Cohen, I'm assuming you met him more than once, but he was an undersecretary for African matters for the United States.
Yes.
Very powerful position.
Yes, I know.
And he debated you and said, no, imperialism doesn't exist.
It's denial.
How could we be in such a situation? Tell us about, well, first of all, I think I can ask you that. Isn't it essential to understand capitalism's as an entity, whatever one thinks of it, and imperialism?
Absolutely, because these are epochal phenomena. They are not something that lasts 10, 20 years and so on. These are things that go on for hundreds of years. Although, of course, capitalism and imperialism both are 300-400 years ago, they are still shorter lifespan than previous epochs of feudalism and slavery and so on. Mm-hmm. So the remarkable thing is that although it's 400, 500 years old, capitalism and imperialism are both on the defensive. They are now facing a crisis, internally crisis within capitalism and within imperialism, and I don't think they are going to last more than another 100 years maximum. Mm-hmm. That's where we are. Struggle.
Well, the context the way you put that in the book, you say that we had this phenomenon of I date it to George Bush Sr., who's saying we have a new world order, and the new world order is going to be run basically out of Washington, New York, London, perhaps Paris, I guess. And the world went, actually we lived for some period of time where people who had been leaders in Asia and Africa were basically shunted aside, mocked. But time has gone by and it's 2019 and you say, they're right, there is a new world order, but it turns out it's not the one they thought it was going to be.
Absolutely, because they are in a state of euphoria about themselves for what they have achieved over the last hundreds of years, that they think this is going to be everlasting. This is an illusion. And, of course, this illusion is getting shattered on a daily basis. They know it now as a reality. It's no longer a fiction. Mm-hmm. They know that the Chinese are putting forward in another order, it still is called, they call it still socialism with Chinese characteristics, but I think it's capitalism with Chinese characteristics. And but they are now making new rules, and these rules are not the same as those that are proposed and enforced on the countries of the South. The Chinese have a new paradigm in the relations with the South than the one that Europe and America has been imposing on the global South. And we can certainly amplify on this if we want to.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. I would use it. Is very. We're in a kind of a language battle here. This man with Pompeo, I guess his name is. He and the other and the British are joined in this too. They say they're warning Africa that they could fall into a debt trap with China. And they say, we're warning Djibouti, for example, you don't get in a debt trap. And to Tanzania, you could. And they even sometimes report in the business section, Tanzania is worried about being in a debt trap. Well, isn't that bunk? I like, by the way, I have to say, you speak a plain language. I want our listeners to know Trade is War is one of the most readable, brilliant books you get your hands on.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Phil. I really appreciate your understanding of my book and my perspective. I really do appreciate that because it is not appreciated very much in the Western world. Believe you me, I launched Trade is War a couple of years ago, both here in Canada and in the United States. And the only people who would come to attend my lectures would be people from the South, mm-hmm. Global South. I live in Oxford. I have launched my book in several universities. And you know what, Phil? Not one professor has put my book on the reading list. Not one.
Well, he's trying to protect them. It's kind of important.
They're protecting the jobs. It's counter to their ideology that free trade is forever and it is good for everybody. The competitive advantages and so on. This is all, as my book says, a whole lot of nonsense. It's never been the case, even during the mercantile period, mm-hmm. when the British were on top of trade. That was not free trade. That was trade backed by military guns, the battleships that UK had. So trade has never been free, except perhaps the pre-capitalist period. So, Phil, I think I'm so pleased that I'm talking with you, and there are people who I hope will listen, that they are living in an illusion. There is no free trade, ever.
Yeah, well, it is a curious phenomenon. I bet you've noticed this, that when one travels, in Canada, there's really fear and alienation of the tremendous power of Washington. It's intuitive. But when the leaders speak, you would think that we're the closest and chummiest and all that. But the general population is quite worried about when a leader like Trump says, we're going to have a trade war, and trade wars are easy to win. Is that true?
Well, trade wars are easy to win for those who have the power.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know much about Canada, but I do know that the U.S. and Canadian relations are almost neocolonial, almost. If you look at the control of American corporate power in Canada, mm-hmm. I've seen it in a few statistics, that's quite shattering to see that American corporate capital and money capital is playing a major role in Canada's economy. Mm-hmm. Even the forestry, for example, paper factory and so on. So you're right. There is a sense of alienation in Canada that is experienced by common people working on the ground, working in forests and in agricultural societies. But when it comes to the elite making policies at the level of state, that is a total denial of the reality on the ground.
Mm-hmm. We are speaking to Yash Tandon. His books are The Trade is War and the Trump Phenomenon and the Emergence of a New World Order. By the way, Yash Tandon is speaking Wednesday night at a different book list at 7 p.m. And I urge everybody to please attend that and definitely get the book, because it really, it's, of course, got a blurb from Noam Chomsky, which is always a good sign. And by the way, I like the introductions and the preface by the other individuals who had worked at the United Nations and other international organizations.
Very good.
And they really did underline how dangerous the situation and how a book like yours is needed to understand it. I liked your story about the World Trade Organization. You know, they always, World Trade Organization, once they have these entities, they become kind of, have a sacred aura about them, like they're wonderful things. And but you told a story that it came from the, originally it was the International Trade Organization, which, because of the prejudicial design of it, had been put aside. I like that story because you mentioned that the French didn't really like, they were worried about being sanctioned. They didn't like the idea that somebody could sanction them.
That's right.
And here we are now with the WTO, and you say, how come they can sanction people? Please talk about that.
That's good, very good, because there are only two in global institutions that have teeth. One is the Security Council of the United Nations. The General Assembly doesn't have teeth, but the Security Council has, because it's a power of sanctions. And the only other institution is the World Trade Organization that has the power of the teeth. It can bite. WTO can bite. If you do not go by the decisions of the WTO, then there follows sanctions. And the curious thing, Phil, and a lot of people don't know this, is that the decisions of the WTO are made in small rooms where only the big powers come, of course, United States, Britain, Japan, France, and so on, and selected few countries from the global south. Maybe India, certainly China, and Brazil, maybe. That's all. And they can make decisions that are then binding on the member countries. I attended the first WTO conference in Singapore, and they were making decisions on the issue of telegraphic communications. And other means of communications. And none of the African countries were presented there. And they didn't even know what decisions were taken. I found it out from my own grapevine. And I then wrote about this. And the short point I want to make is that although, as we Africans say, Africans' hair was combed in their absence. That's what the Africans say. The Africans got their hair combed when they were not there, and the decisions that were made behind the scenes are then enforced on us. If we do not comply to those decisions, then sanctions follow automatically. So in that sense, WTO is worse than the Security Council. Because in the Security Council, there is at least a rule that says that the permanent members should say yes, and then a few other members, non-permanent members. WTO, no. It just is a free-fall sanctions imposed on countries of the South, weaker countries of the South, that have no say in the making of these decisions. So this is an appalling institution, WTO.
Yeah. And you mentioned that the Singapore conference, was it 97?
That's right.
Now, that I was shocked reading your book that the African states basically signed on with the WTO without reading, and more importantly, without taking this to their national assemblies, to any parliament. That must have been, what, tsunami time in the imperialist world? I mean, they just said, okay, here's how we're going to do this, and here's where you sign?
You know, I did write also that it's amazing, Phil, because we have fought against colonialism even after ever independence. We still are fighting against imperialism. nonetheless, among our elite who make decisions within the state bureaucracy and the bureaucracy itself, there is a feeling that our masters make decisions and they make for our good. So therefore, we don't have to read the text of the WTO or the decisions made in Singapore. We simply take for granted that our masters have our wish, our good interest in their heart.
Uh-huh.
It's absurd. When I returned from Singapore, I talked to the Minister of Trade in Zimbabwe. That's where I was then. Mm-hmm. And he agreed with me. And then we founded, I talk about that in my book also, we founded an organization called CIATINI, Southern and Eastern African Trade Information and Negotiations Institute. Mm-hmm. So I have an institute that tries to demystify the technical language in which the jargon in which the WTO decisions are made, and to make them understandable by our negotiators in our capital. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have made some progress, certainly in East African countries, we are making progress.
Mm-hmm.
But there it is, the Global South is exploited by an institution in which they have marginal say.
Well, isn't, now that's something, I did some work in Tanzania myself, I traveled there a bit, and during the time I was there, which is basically 97 through 2010, I guess, there was a noticeable shift in political rhetoric. When I arrived in 97 in Arusha, it was all about, we've got to learn how to be entrepreneurs. We've got to go out there and pull up ourselves by our bootstraps, and we've got to bring in more NGOs who know how to grow crops. And obviously, all these crops we've been growing for 1,000 years, that doesn't count.
That's right.
And it was just pouring salt on their head, basically. This was the intelligentsia. But actually, over the years, it has shifted. And a lot of this has to do, does it not, with NATO's overreach, the arrogance of regime change, and I want to ask you about that, which has kind of caused people to wake up.
Absolutely. You put your finger on the right spot. I think the overreach of NATO is just overwhelming. The United States have bases in most of the countries in Africa. Also, they train our military and weaponry that we buy from the West mostly. And the way they have bombed Somalia, Eritrea, and of course they have provoked war. The West has provoked war between Kenya and Somalia. Kenya has no business bombarding Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
They should be amicable. And Uganda has no business sending troops to Somalia to take the chestnuts out of the fire for the United States, because that's what Uganda is doing. But this is going too far, and now the people are challenging our regimes. They're fed up of this. And I think we are living in an interesting period. We are living in a slow shift towards recognizing the reality on the ground that our people in Africa face.
Mm-hmm.
You're right about that.
Mm-hmm. The regime, they actually, in their heyday, were able to pass that thing at the National, at the UN Assembly, about responsibility to protect, and they strapped on their helmets and began to attack people.
Right.
I mean, what a nasty idea. And isn't it a violation? You mentioned universal United Nations position on human rights. I forget the terminology. But that RT, you can't have responsibility to protect and the basic UN charter. Those two things can't work.
That's right. I think you're right there, too. Very strange, though. You might have, I don't know whether I mentioned my book or not, but Germany was not part of that resolution that was passed in the General Assembly. It abstained.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting, because it shows that between some European countries and the United States. Of course, UK is always behind the United States, without saying. But the point you're making is very important. Responsibility to protect what? Because at the end of the day, they are protecting their own interests in our countries. They are protecting the regimes that are only saying yes to the commands that are given to them from NATO countries, and that's what they are protecting. And if you don't protect the interests of the Western countries in our countries, then, of course, they have to carry out regime change. So then the regime has to conform to the imperial interests. That's right.
Yeah. Again, it's Yash Tandon. He's speaking Wednesday at 7 o'clock at a different book list, 779 Bathurst. The book is Trade is War, the West War Against the World. And I want to ask you about this, the use of intellectual property. Knowing a little bit of American history, I mean, they started off by ripping off everybody they could.
Right.
People like writer Charles Dickens couldn't get his money because the Americans reprinted his books and didn't pay him.
That's right.
You point out is this owning patents. The North owns all the patents. I think you said 95% of the patents are in the hands of the old gang, colonial gang. How can you do anything? I mean, you have to buy the blasted thing, and you have to pay them while you're trying to develop yourself.
That's right.
Can you talk about that?
Yes, indeed. In fact, I started the chapter by saying that if you eat orange, then there is no orange left for anybody else. You have eaten it. But if you consume knowledge, then it is not finished. Knowledge shared is knowledge accumulated by all. So intellectual property is a very interesting term. They call it property. But the intellectual products of intellect and mind should be shared by everybody. And that was the reality until quite recently, actually. I think it's hardly 100 years that you had these transformation of the products of mind and knowledge into a property. They propertized it, like all capitalist tendency tends to. So IP has become now the one of the major means, in fact, one of the major weapons of controlling production both agriculture and industrial production in the global south. But the things are changing, Phil. I think we are now witnessing a shift. If you look at the patents now that are registered in Geneva and other countries, China used to be sixth or seventh only about 2 to 3 years ago. China is now second, above Germany and Japan. And I reckon that another 10 years' time, China could be the top producer of intellectual property. Then it'll be interesting to see whether China also uses the intellectual property as a weapon of, I don't know, that's something in the future we have to look out for.
Well, that'll be one of the symptoms people will study. You mentioned there's a term, what is it, the green, permanent green or something, the trick of renewing a patent.
Yes.
Which is, and it is just a trick, right?
It's a trick.
Yeah, and you, right. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, they say for Europe, for example, which provide subsidies to their agriculture products, these are called green subsidies. Green subsidies are not violating WTO rules. All other kinds of subsidies are violation of WTO rules. So the Europeans and the Americans have been able to work around the question of negative subsidies, mm-hmm. by allowing those that are permissible to them in agriculture. And if you look at the way both Europe and America have shifted their subsidies from red and blue to green is enormous.
Mm-hmm.
So they can easily do that by fabricating the figures and statistics and the production systems. And so what is happening is the Western countries are taking advantage of this loophole that they have created for themselves on green subsidies, while the rest of the world are caught up in the so-called red and blue subsidies, mm-hmm. and they can't escape from there. And that, again, subjects the countries of the South to further sanctions by dominant countries in the WTO. Yeah. So it's an amazing world.
Yeah. By the way, we want your thoughts on this matter of sanctions. Again, that's become lately just like a drumbeat. It hardly a week goes by that the U.S. administration doesn't announce sanctions. But you say in the book, sanctions actually is an act of war.
Sanctions is what, sorry?
Is an act of war.
Oh, yes. Well,
we have a foreign minister who speaks of rule of law and our values, but that's outside the law. State cannot sanction other states, right? I mean, there are international bodies to whom you could take a problem.
Exactly. And in fact, in international law, sanctions are regarded as part of war. That's the beginning of war. Economic sanctions is part of war.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as you rightly say, this kind of imposition of sanctions has become such a regular phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
such an action that is done almost every day, and they print out the word sanctions in the news media as if it was a daily affair. So Trump can announce sanctions against Iran, against Syria, and against Russia and China, all these countries.
Cuba, yes.
And these are all acts of war.
Yes.
So yes, you're right.
And the target of it, simply, they have to bear the pain. Because their only option, basically, I mean, they, sooner or later, if, of course, they face asphyxiation, they have to do things. And that, of course, we're hearing about that in the Strait of Hormuz. And to me, the most amazing act was the British taking a ship at Gibraltar. Of all places, by the way, since Gibraltar doesn't belong to them. But
exactly.
But, I mean, right. This escalation has to be a little worrying, right?
Yes, yes. I think the Americans and the Europeans who live in illusion to think that they can sanction Iran in the Gulf of Hormuz and get away with it, that won't happen. This is nonsense, because this then frees Iran to go and produce more, probably use the uranium for weapons.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't done so at the moment. But the more pressure is put on to Iran by Europe and America, mm-hmm. on sanctions, Iran will have no choice but to do what is absolutely necessary to protect its sovereignty and its territorial integrity. So these people are living in illusion. They are not going to. They can't mess around with Iran. Iran is not like Syria. It's not a small country. It's a huge country and had 3,000 years of civilization behind it. You can't just play around with Iran as if it is one of the dismembered states of the Middle East. No. So I think it's better that the government of Britain and America come to their senses.
Yeah.
They are provoking something that could, accident or by design, could become a world war, catastrophic world war.
Mm-hmm. Of which Americans actually have never experienced, since World War II didn't strike them. People had their homes burned down all over Europe, but the Americans thought they were in a war, but they only sent soldiers.
Exactly.
It's kind of, but that is, we are living in a kind of a situation of where, the, I guess for us, the danger is a delusional sort of attitude. After all, this most charming man, very eloquent, Obama, President Obama, he went to the Naval Academy and he said, in every fiber of my being, I believe in American exceptionalism.
I think I have quoted him somewhere. I don't know whether in this book or another book. Obama, who got a Peace Prize, by the way.
Yes.
He was himself very embarrassed that he was given a Peace
Before
Prize.
Bombing Libya, he got the prize.
No, Obama has really put weapons where his mouth is.
Yeah. But in a sense, that's what they all share, right? This thing about make America great again. The whole thing is about being number one and being great and exceptional state. That is, for the rest of us, the most dangerous thing.
That's right. I call it Muganomics. And that's what the economics is. Make America great again. Muganomics.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's an illusion. It's an illusion. It's a shattering illusion. Because what both Europe and America are facing is decline of their empires.
Yeah.
And the trouble with declining empires is that during their winter, they become more aggressive,
yes,
like Roman Empire did also. Yeah. And they know that there's going to be a major global political shift in another two, three decades. I don't give more, two, three, four decades at the most.
Mm-hmm.
And the empire would have crumbled.
Yeah.
It's already crumbling, by the way.
Yeah.
In my view, Brexit is part of that. Europe is also, in a sense, crumbling. There is an upsurge of national and xenophobism in all these countries. So we are seeing that the old empire is crumbling under our feet as we walk on it.
Wow. Well, it's eloquently stated. It's Yash Tandon. You're going to be speaking Wednesday, 7 o'clock at 779 Bathurst. And I look forward to seeing you. I hope everybody gets this book. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much, Phil. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Pleasure talking to you.
Bye-bye. Right.
Bye-bye. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT, just like I said. And Jessica's been running the whole show very efficiently. And so we are very fortunate and thankful. And we will see you next week.
CIUT 89.5 FM, the station that brings you music from the African diaspora with Emil Weeks.
Great Concept Radio.
A new generation of sound.
Great Concept Radio.
Thursday nights at 10, CIUT 89.5 FM, the sound of your city. Devil's music, not seeing artistic evolution. She turned.